Okay, the audio feed is now live. I forgot about that one. Something I have to remember. So, how are you, Robin?
Well, how are you, Pumpkin?
I'm okay, but are you really? You had a long day. Are you tired?
No, I had a shorter day than I did yesterday.
Oh, but very busy still. Okay. So, hit me with some questions.
Okay. Going back to yesterday, because we didn't finish.
We didn't.
My mind is very busy during walking meditation, so much so that I would have to stop very frequently to note them all. Should I stop frequently and note them until they go away, or let them go and keep walking?
If they're just minor distractions, yes, you can just let them go. I mean, there's no hard and fast rule. Maybe sometimes it's better to stop. Maybe sometimes it's better to keep going. You have to be clever and sort of get a sense of what's useful at the time. It's not magic. It's not a video game that you have to figure out and then you get points or something. It's you. It's you learning about reality. If you think it's not going to help you that much to stop and look at thoughts, then you have permission not to stop. But if they're serious and real distractions, certainly don't ignore them. You should stop and say, if it's lots of little thoughts, then you should stop and say, distracted, distracted. Become aware of your state of mind.
One day, I have heard that the Buddha had talked about qualities that one could develop, which would lead one to be reborn in higher realms. Could you please explain those qualities that the Buddha talked about?
Which ones are those?
Qualities leading to higher realms. Haven't you said, generosity?
There's four. Silang, Sutang, Jagang, Jagapanya, I think. But there's many lists, you know. I mean, that's one list. That's one list that's probably most well known. Well, it's fairly well known. Silang, you need to have morality. Morality is something that leads you to heaven. Sutang, learning, being well learned. Must be, yeah. Sutang is one of them. Jaga means generosity. And Panya is wisdom. These four things, these are the Deva Dhammas, I think. Things that lead you to heaven.
If you were able to get a monastery with acreage, would it be acceptable for supporters to be residents and do something like farming to support the monastery? I think I understood you to say earlier that it would not be acceptable for monks to farm. But what about supporting residents? Is there such a thing that could be acceptable?
Could be acceptable, not ideal. Obviously you don't, this is the thing, a monastery should be a place where people are engaged in meditation. A farm should be separate from the monastery. But you could divide land into two parts. You have the meditation center on one part, and then you have the lay society on another part. And so people living in one part could farm and go to work and do as they like, and then people in the other part would engage in study and practice. Could do it that way. But this would be in the case where there was no other way to get, there was no way to get food, because ideally you're using the space for meditation and for meditation center.
When monks are in monasteries in Asia, this is just my own question here. When monks are in monasteries in Asia, do they get tasks to do, like housekeeping?
Yeah, like, I mean, if it's a good monastery, yeah. Most often they don't, actually, and they just do it when they feel like it. It's pretty good, you know. Many monasteries are good about keeping things clean, but often they end up, the bigger monasteries end up hiring someone to do it because the monks are not doing it. But if a monastery gets really big, the monks couldn't possibly do it because they're too busy and there's too much space, too much to do. So they do have to hire people. But monks have duties in like in my teacher's monastery. It's pretty good about giving everyone, honestly, it's not all that good, or it wasn't. It may have gotten better, but it's hard to give monks in Thailand anyway duties in most monasteries, because there's a sense that you can't tell them what to do. There's this idea, sort of the feeling that you can't tell them what to do. So the nuns, the white-clothed nuns, all have duties, and they're really well organized. But the monks, from what I've seen, not so much. It's unfortunate, really. They all should have duties.
Are there novice men as well, like the equivalent of the white-clothed nuns, or is that
No.
different?
No, we tried to do that for one of my meditators, because nuns can get a special visa, but they wouldn't let a man become a nun. They said because they have men have the option of becoming a bhikkhu, but he couldn't because he's from Iran and his mother was still there, and he could never go back to Iran as a monk.
So what happened?
He went back to Iran. I think it was more that his parents weren't even going to give him permission. That was another part of it. Can't remember, one or the other. But I think, yeah, he couldn't go back.
That's hard.
Yeah.
If we feel a lot of love during Vipassana, are we doing it wrong?
No. No, wrong about Vipassana. Vipassana meditation is trying to gain insight. Hence the word vipassana, into what's going on. So you have, if you have love, then you try to gain insight into this, the nature of love. You can say feeling or love, love. And then you see that love is impermanent suffering and non-self. Meaning love is just another experience that comes and it goes. It's unsatisfying. It's not what we're looking for. It's not the goal. I mean, nothing that your experience is. It's just about seeing things arise and cease until you let go of everything, even love.
When an insect flies near your ear, or if you step near a snake, your reptile brain kicks in. At that point, you lose all mindfulness for survival. Should this be a natural thing?
I do. How do you know? Telling me I have a reptile brain. Now, it's true that our brain sometimes kicks in, but the mind has a part to play, and this is what mindfulness is. Mindfulness is the gatekeeper. Your brain can tell you, swat it, swat it, but if you're mindful, you can just say wanting, wanting, or intending. You can note the intention and not do anything. There's no reptile. Well, I mean, there is the brain that tells you, do it, do it. But there's a choice. There's a moment where mindfulness can neutralize it.
Is it common to feel a lot of love during Vipassana?
Not terribly. It's common to think about people who are dear to you, like your parents. That's a big one where people will often, I would say the majority of people who go through a course will at some point think about people like their parents, people who they strong, who they have strong emotional ties to. And usually it's with love and with gratitude and that kind of thing. If there's anything to be grateful for, which usually there is for most of us. But it's not that it doesn't happen, it's just to say that it's a thing that happens to most people or the majority of people. Not while you're practicing Vipassana. I mean, we often add it to our Vipassana practice. We'll send love after our practice, may all beings be happy. Hence we have this little heart there to signify that that's what you're doing.
Can we practice more the more we practice?
I don't know what that means. Oh wait, Do we practice more the more we practice?
Can we practice more?
Can we practice more? I don't really understand.
I think I understand, but maybe I don't. You know, do you have to build up to longer? Maybe do you have to build up to longer meditation sessions? And things like that.
I still don't understand.
You can start out meditating for, you know, hours at a time.
Oh, I see. Well, the more you practice, it makes you able to do more?
I think that's what the question is.
Well, that makes sense.
We have the ability to practice more or more intensely the more we practice.
Sure. I mean, isn't that sort of obvious?
And maybe if I got your question wrong, please resubmit it, because I might have been interpreting it wrong. And the next question is, why do some people get a heart instead of a V when they finish meditation? Because they clicked on...
Because we love them more.
No.
No, that's not it.
They clicked on the check mark to signal that they're sending metta. Bhante, what is your opinion on guns?
They are things that you use to kill other beings. Not very good. Some people use them just for fun, right? Shooting targets. So there's that, but you know, then it's just for fun. Some people, what else could they use guns for? Maybe they use them to defend themselves, right? So you have a gun in your house to defend yourself. I mean, that would be one that I could understand and say, okay, well, there you have a valid point. But then the question is, would you kill a person in self-defense? Because that's not ethical. Maybe you just shoot them in the leg or something. I don't know. Bad idea, I think, having a gun, because then you might end up shooting someone, even in self-defense or in defense of someone else, which... not the best way. Not the best thing.
What to do about subtle happiness, or rather subtle contentment? Can one feel content and not have a preference for it?
You can feel strong happiness and not have a preference for it. Happiness isn't the problem. It's the attachment. So if you're happy and you say happy, happy, you can have strong happiness. That's fine. But as soon as you start to like it, then you've got a problem.
Bhante, you talk about mindfulness. What does it mean to be mindful when not meditating?
I think this is someone who hasn't read my booklet. Chapter 6. But it sounds like they don't even know what I mean by mindfulness. Who is it? Where are they?
Okay, 32 minutes ago.
They're orange. I've done a little meditation with us. Hi, John. He's even got a picture. Well, I would recommend you read my booklet all the way through, because it answers this question.
It's a fair question, because mindfulness is used for so many different things, so many different generic things. You hear it constantly.
Sure.
And people are referring to a lot of different things. So.
I mean, maybe I don't use the word mindfulness much in the book, but the book's all about mindfulness, even if I don't use that word. The word mindfulness isn't necessarily the best translation. It's just a common word that we use as a catchphrase. But I'm a little more precise in the book about the idea of creating a clear thought. That's what we mean by being mindful, to have a clear thought, clear awareness of something, clear recognition, this is this, not anything else.
You hear that so much just in general conversation. People really mean being careful or being thoughtful.
You should read, my father just sent me a link to an article in the New York Times, maybe just this evening, about this guy who was complaining about evangelical meditators who proselytize and push meditation. And if he, when he says, I don't meditate, trying to convert him to meditation. It's really a terrible article, because then he goes on to say, he talks about other ways you can gain mindfulness and explains them, and it's just like, you really don't know what mindfulness is, do you? I mean, not to blame the person, because mindfulness is just, as you say, used for so many, to mean so many things. So he was saying, like, you can use drugs for stress relief, right? Because everyone says meditation is for stress relief. Well, it's a little deeper than that. Meditation, ideally, is for changing your habits so you don't create stress in the first place. And drugs won't do that.
But for someone with no background, the idea that it's stress relief is that's kind of what brought me to meditation initially, because I was very stressed out. And the idea that something would relieve this terrible stress that I was feeling was very appealing. And then it was only through time and learning more and more and more that it became more. But that was definitely what drew me to it
Well,
initially.
I mean, it really is it is the truth. It is for stress relief. Dukkha is often translated as stress, so it's true. But it's not stress relief, probably in the way you were thinking of it, or in the way most people think of it. It's deeper than that. And I guess it's not just that it goes beyond stress relief. Stress relief itself has to go beyond our ordinary thinking about stress. It's not just turning the stress off. It's about changing our habits so we don't create the stress in the first place. Still stress relief, but it's long-term, lasting, sustainable stress relief. Permanent stress relief.
But something you have to learn through the process. It
Yeah.
doesn't make sense if you don't have any background in
Yeah.
it.
But there is an argument to be made that it's simplistic to say that what's meditation good for? Oh, stress relief calms you. You know, it's true. And in fact, it is sort of the final goal, in fact, but we have to be knowledgeable enough to say it's not just like a drug, which is what my book is all about. The start of the book is about. There's two kinds of meditation: meditation that's like a drug and meditation that's like a medicine. One makes you feel good and relieves your symptoms, the other cures the disease.
Monday, last night when you were meditating, I noticed your head kept nodding. What is the cause for that?
I don't talk about my own meditation, sorry.
Plus, that means this person wasn't meditating. They were watching you meditate.
Well, no, they can watch the video, it was recorded.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Sorry.
But still, that's kind of perverse, sitting there watching someone else meditate.
Are you working on a second book of meditation?
Yeah, I've done how many chapters? Four chapters already. Two more in the works. We'll see when. Hopefully this week I'll do another one.
What's the easiest way for someone to access that if they wanted to read it?
I think
I'd go
it's
through
on.
your Google Plus page, but there's probably a more direct way.
No, it's on Siri Mungalo, I think. It wasn't until fairly recently, but. If you go to teachings, text, how to meditate too, and it brings up a page. And yes, there are four chapters.
Hi, Bhante. When should one increase meditation time and when should one decrease it?
Well, within reason, increase it when you have the time. But it should be up to a point where you're fairly comfortable being mindful. You know, you should push yourself a little bit, but don't push yourself too much so that it becomes a chore and that you get negative conditioning towards meditation where you begin to hate it because it's just stressful. So it should be comfortable, but push you a little bit, challenge you a little bit. And you have to get a sense of that. Now, when you're on a meditation course, we'll just keep pushing you and pushing you and pushing you. I mean, we'll keep challenging you. So the teacher will do that for you. Now, if you're really interested in this kind of thing and you're able to do at least an hour a day, you can sign up for one of our courses. Just sign up for an appointment slot and start practicing, and I'll help you progress. Although I haven't been talking too much about times. I haven't told people do this many minutes, increase a little bit, but not so much, because mostly it's up to their schedules.
How much did the Buddha know? Did he know everything?
That's what they say. But he didn't know everything. You see, that's not how it works. Knowing everything requires infinite number of minds, right? Because only one mind can only know one thing. The point was, anything he thought about, he could find the answer to with unobstructed knowledge.
What is the singing bowl used for?
I don't know, ask the Tibetans. I don't use a singing bowl. I have one here, but it was actually just to create a bell noise for our meditation timer.
The head monk at Wat Lao uses, I believe it is a singing bowl to signal the start and end of the meditation. I'm pretty sure it's a singing bowl. I mean, it has that sound. Anything else?
Yeah, that's common. We use them to ring as a signal.
Certain end of meditation. I have been focusing my noting on feelings of pressure, stiffness, flaccidity, etc. Where do these fit into the four elements, and how should we note the other elements?
That's the vayu-dhatu, pressure, stiffness, flaccidity. That's the air element. That's the rising and falling of the stomach is also the air element. Fire element is heat and cold, so you would say hot, hot, or cold, cold, or just feeling, feeling. And the hardness and softness is the earth element, so you'll feel it on when you're sitting, you'll feel it on the chair, or you'll feel it on the floor, the carpet, or whatever you're, or the hard floor that you're sitting on. Then you can just note feeling.
Anna can hear you speaking through my speakers. Ooh, sorry about that. Sitting back a little bit.
It should do a noise cancellation, but it's not perfect.
I heard Shinzen Young talking about meditation-induced derealization, depersonalization episode. Is this really a risk?
I've actually heard of this. Someone was arguing that the Goenka technique leads to depersonalization, derealization. I mean, we don't use those terms, but I remember vaguely when we were talking about this, I looked it up, and part of it sounds okay. I mean, you know, you're losing your ego, you're losing your sense of self. Well, yeah, that's sort of the point, because then you lose your ego, your attachment to self. But I think part of it was just sort of, I mean, yeah, anything's possible. The mind is a powerful thing. If you abuse it, you can go crazy. Doesn't mean you shouldn't take a course to learn how to train it in the proper way. It won't happen if you have a good guide and are clear about where you're going, what you're doing. Certainly won't happen in this technique if you know, if you follow the teachings. We've had people go, I've seen people go crazy because they didn't have good guidance and they totally misunderstood what was being taught. So they'd start saying like wisdom, 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 or they'd use it, they'd use the mantra. Mantras are powerful, so either you would use them to try and get what they wanted, like so saying wisdom, wisdom, or so on. Repeating their name over and over again. I mean, it's, yeah, you could drive yourself crazy if you do that.
If one experiences nodding of the head during sitting meditation, can it be just due to letting go in a profound way, or can it happen when the body is tired? Thank you, Bonfey.
Clever, clever. But you know what? You haven't done any meditation, so I'm not going to answer that one. You be clever, I can be clever too. You have to ask that again when once you've done some meditation with us. Sorry. We're all caught up.
We're all caught up.
We had 45 people watching our YouTube stream there for a second.
Thanks.
So, I mean, to be doing this daily and having people listen, people watching, it's great that we've got a community. It's great to see people. I had a conversation today with one of the online meditators. He had been trying to create a meditation group in his area. And he said he's heard that people have tried this around universities, thinking that university would be a good place. And he said something curious. He said it's almost impossible to do around a university. It's almost impossible. And then he said, but to do it in a place where there is no university is impossible. So that was quite interesting. You know, no, I'm feeling good about this place. Honestly, I think a university is a great place. It's great because of the turnover. You always have new people who you can help. It's like having a community of new blood always coming in. So you may not reach people in a terribly profound way, but you're able to reach a lot of people as they come and stay for 4 years and then go. And the other thing is the people I'm meeting now will be around for another 4 years, right? So by the time we hit our fourth year, we'll have people who really know that we're here. And then that'll stay, and new people will constantly be coming. Whereas in another community, you have the people who you have in the community, and it's more static. So, honestly, I'm sure we can do good things here. Even if it just means giving people good advice or kind words or... It's really neat being in Canada, honestly. I mean, it's probably just because I'm familiar with the culture, but it's not really, you know, I get, every time we get off the bus, this really curious thing happens. 75% of the people who get off the local public transit say thank you to the bus driver. Even if they're getting off at the back of the bus, they shout out, thank you. And it's curious to me because, well, the person's just doing their job. They're not really doing you a favor, but it's kind of neat. So I started doing it, and now every time I get off, I say thank you. It's just whatever.
I saw that in Canada too, on the buses.
They do that where you're from?
Not so much, but I actually always do. When I get off a bus, I always say thank you. I really am thankful that they were a safe driver and I made it to my destination in one place.
And that they're nice to you. I mean, part of it, I think, is sort of the appreciation that they're not being a jerk, and because some bus drivers can be, very few, but you know, there's a potential to have a little bit. I was in it's funny, the U.S. buses in some places are really weird. I was in San Luis Obispo, I think. Gee, it's a long time ago, but I was somewhere in California and I stood up on the bus. And he said, sit down. I was like, there was two or three people on the public bus. And I stood up because I wanted to get a brochure that was in one of the pockets, you know, or the timetable. And so I sat down, and then he stopped at a stoplight. And I got up again to get a, to, and he stopped the bus. And he came over and he started, you know. Anyway, I don't know where this story is going, but it gets back to the point of kindness, and there's that, and there's people holding open doors for each other, and just being in a society where you have the, there's something about university students, whatever else you may say about them, is there is a sense of love, friendliness, and harmony. You know, there's, It's not like a work environment where people are competing, right? We're helpful. You know, some guy came and asked me for my notes for one of the classes, so I sent them to him by email. And he was very thankful. And people do this, you know, they send each other their notes and help each other out and are kind and hold doors open for each other. And it really is a positive environment in those aspects. I think probably the big one is the alcohol and drugs. More alcohol, but both. And, you know, just sort of the, what do you call the hedonism, That's a big thing in the West, with people around that age especially. But there's good potential.
I wonder if it's different with the evening classes. I always had taken a lot of evening classes, and it was an older group, mostly adults working during the day.
Right. There are quite a few evening classes, but I'm reluctant to take any because of this, because of what I'm doing in the evening. There's a couple of good evening classes. I may have to just bite the bullet and say, one day a week we are not having evening session.
I wonder if the students understand the benefits of meditation. I mean, even the fact that through meditation, it's, you know, your mind is clearer and it's easier probably to study and remember things.
I've been thinking the same thing. I'm thinking maybe to create a poster that lists the benefits, because we haven't done much of that. We've advertised meditation, but we haven't given information as to why a student should be interested in meditation.
It's not maybe ultimate reality that grabs you right at first, because you don't know enough to be interested in ultimate reality. It's more, you know, that it relieves stress or that it helps you have a clearer mind. Or
absolutely right.
Gateway.
Okay. Anyway, that's it for tonight. Thank you all for tuning in. Thank you, Robin, for helping out.
Thank you.
See you all later. Bye.
Good night.